Israeli forces once again attacked Palestinians at Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds, leaving dozens of worshippers injured. Afghan officials announced the arrest of the mastermind of Thursday's deadly Daesh-claimed attack on a Shia mosque in a northern city. And the mayor of Ukraine's Mariupol calls for the full evacuation of the city a day after Russia claimed control over the strategic port. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Tensions simmering in occupied Al-Quds, where Israeli forces have once again attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. So far, at least 43 Palestinians are confirmed injured. Israeli forces made arrests too. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas reacted to the latest attack on Al-Aqsa Mosque. The movement said it is closely monitoring the situation there and it is fully ready to respond to Israeli crimes against Palestinian people. Hamas also called on the international community to restrain the occupying Israeli regime and stop its aggression against Al-Aqsa. Tensions at the holy site began last Friday when Israeli forces attacked Palestinian worshippers, injuring scores of them. The aggression is taking place during the fasting month of Ramadan. Earlier, we talked to international lawyer and political commentator Barry Grossman for his thoughts on Israel's intensified crackdown on the Palestinians. He believes international bodies are pressurized by the U.S. into inaction on the regime's atrocities.
But the reality is, as we've seen for many years now, that under U.S. pressure, U.S. threat, and U.S. guidance, the international, so-called international community has been basically silenced under threat of consequences should they say or do anything that would amount to leaving Palestinians alone to deal with Israelis to reach a settlement of what they like to call the Palestinian problem. In other words, international law has been deemed by the Americans not to be applicable in the various institutions, be it the United Nations or the World Court or the World Criminal Court, have all been basically declared by the Americans to be out of bounds. There are moves on foot to try and criminalize certain war crimes committed by the occupation, but we see they're moving very slowly with an incredible amount of accompanying noise and threats, even against the court and the judges and investigators presiding over that process. So I wouldn't be holding my breath waiting for the international community, least of all the UN Security Council, to do their job, to fulfill their function.
In the run-up to International Quds Day, the UK-based Rights Group is calling on supporters of the Palestinian struggle to lift their voices in support and solidarity. The 2022 edition of the Fly the Flag for Palestine campaign is an opportunity to remind Palestinians living under occupation and the diaspora that they are not alone. Amina Taylor has more.
Violence, oppression, and desecration of holy sites. Just more of the Ramadan reminders that Palestinians continue to live under occupation and suffer daily injustices. More than ever, international solidarity, especially in an age of social media, is important. With the atrocities being committed against Palestinians, raising awareness and exhibiting support is more crucial than before. This year's Fly the Flag for Palestine campaign is giving millions across the world the opportunity to show solidarity by displaying a Palestinian flag in person or online.
If we are not able to stand up at this hour of need and be supportive to those Palestinians by holding a flag on our car, on our shops, on our homes, then what are we good for? And when are we going to do this? And I think what I have seen, ordinary people responding so fantastically.
In the lead up to the annual Al-Quds rally in the British capital, the global support for the campaign is in full swing.
Organizers are encouraging participation in this year's event, and taking part could not be more simple. First of all, please post your image or your footage online, encourage a few friends to do the same, and of course, use the hashtag.
As the global solidarity movement grows, so does the opposition, a fact not lost on pro-Palestine campaigners.
We got ministers coming and saying, you know, they're going to refer us to the police for saying from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. It's outrageous. These are the same people that actually articulate that freedom of speech is absolute, and you know they go on and on. What's wrong with any part of the world to be free? What's wrong with asking people to be free?
So organizers are urging you to do your part. Lift your voice in solidarity and fly the flag for Palestine. Amina Taylor, London.
The cost of living crisis is worsening in the UK, with retail sales sliding fast while consumer confidence nears all-time lows. Retail sales dropped by 1.4% in March from February. That is according to the Office for National Statistics. Market research firm GFK also said consumer confidence fell in April, close to its lowest level in nearly 50 years. In the meantime, inflation is now at 7%, the highest in 30 years, and it is likely to increase further beyond the 2% target of the central bank. British households have already cut spending to cope with higher costs of food and fuel, and that is expected to worsen in the coming months, with energy companies warning of what they call truly horrific bills crisis in autumn. The bills already saw a sharp jump this month in the wake of the Ukraine war. Our correspondent Amina Taylor in London gives us details about the cost of living crisis in the UK and how people are coping with it.
The energy price rise that you mentioned there, which for some consumers was more than 50%, so that will be ensuring that consumer confidence is low. Something else that hasn't been mentioned is that we've been cutting back on buying not just things online that would be non-essentials, but food bills since November. Well, those have been shrinking as people think about ways in which they can kind of manage the pennies. Now, we throw around figures sometimes like 7% inflation rate, the Bank of England putting up the base rate to 0.75% and so on. But let's just drill down a little bit about what that actually means for people like myself who earn more than the average wage here. So I can't even tell you about how those less fortunate are going to be, because the picture is so startling. It's such a negative outlook.
The Taliban in Afghanistan say they have arrested a Daesh member in connection with a Thursday attack on a Shia mosque in the north. The Taliban say the terrorist was the mastermind of the deadly blast in Mazar-e-Sharif. The Daesh terror group had claimed the attack on the mosque. It also took responsibility for another explosion that hit the northern city of Kunduz on Thursday. At least four people lost their lives in that blast. The explosions were the latest in a series of deadly attacks targeting Afghan cities since the Taliban takeover last August. A top Russian general says his country will try to take full control of eastern and southern Ukraine as part of the second phase of the special operation there. Major General Rustam Minakiev says that taking Donbass and southern Ukraine will provide a land corridor to the Crimean Peninsula. His comments come a day after Russia took control of the port city of Mariupol in the south. President Vladimir Putin said the city is now liberated, but the Ukrainian counterpart, his Ukrainian counterpart, that is, Volodymyr Zelensky, promised that Mariupol will continue to resist. Mariupol's mayor says around 1,000 people remain trapped there and has called for the full evacuation of the city.
The war in Ukraine could be entering a new stage, as Russia says it has achieved its biggest victory since it launched its offensive nearly 2 months ago. Russian President Vladimir Putin announced on Thursday that Russian forces have won the battle for the strategic southern city of Mariupol. Russian forces appear to be in control of the city, including its important but now seriously damaged port. At a joint appearance with his defense minister Sergei Shoigu, Putin declared that, quote, the completion of combat work to liberate Mariupol is a success. The Russian president offered congratulations to Shoigu and Russian forces. But what is the strategic significance of the latest developments of the war? Mariupol is a major port in Ukraine's eastern Donbass region. It is situated between areas held by pro-Russian forces in Ukraine and Crimea, the Black Sea Peninsula that came under Russian control in 2014. Taking the city now will allow Russia to connect the two areas as it steps up its military campaign in Ukraine's east. Moscow can now secure more of the southern coastline, complete a land bridge between Russian soil and the Crimean Peninsula, and free up more troops to join the battle for Donbass, which is Ukraine's eastern industrial heartland. Despite Russia's announcement of victory in Mariupol, hundreds of Ukrainian troops and civilians are still holding out inside a giant steel factory in the city. Russian forces have tried for weeks to dislodge them, but to no avail.
The Russian president says his troops do not need to enter the sprawling steelworks in Mariupol for now, and the Kremlin has ordered Russian troops to block off this industrial area. Ukraine says Putin wants to avoid a final clash in the industrial complex because he lacks enough troops to defeat them.
The Kremlin says there is no need for Russian troops to enter the complex passageways of the sprawling Azovstal steelworks. The Russian president ordered his forces to block off the industrial area so that, quote, not even a fly can get through. Ukraine and its Western allies have disputed Russia's claim of complete victory in the city. But Moscow seems to be already looking beyond the southern city. Russian officials say the war's main objective is now capturing the mostly Russian-speaking Donbass region.
As I speak, the Russian army controls an area in Ukraine which is larger than England and Wales combined, from Kharkov to Donetsk to Lugansk to Zaporozhye to Kherson. And as a result of the ongoing battle at present in the Donbass, it looks like that the Russian army will increase even further the land it controls in eastern Ukraine and also in southern Ukraine.
Last month, Russian forces were driven away from the capital Kiev and northern Ukraine. Things will definitely not be smooth in the east either, as Western nations rush to funnel heavy arms into Ukraine to help it counter the offensive.
The Ukrainian armed forces were trained by NATO, equipped by NATO, and trained to the standards of NATO. So that is a major factor as to why the Ukrainian armed forces have put up stiff resistance to the Russian army.
U.S. President Joe Biden has announced another $800 million to help Ukrainian forces fight in the east. He said this week that Washington and its allies are moving as fast as possible to provide Kiev with the weapons that it needs. According to Biden, the U.S. and its allies are facing a critical window of time where they are going to set the stage for the next phase of this war. Much is at stake in Ukraine for major world powers. The war has been widely described as an escalation of the never-ending tug of war between the West and the Russian Federation. The outcome of the conflict could have far-reaching consequences and may shift the balance of power in the region and beyond.
And Iran's capital, Tehran, is hosting the International Quran Exhibition. The event, held every year during the fasting month of Ramadan, showcases the latest Quranic products from across the Muslim world. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Islam's holy book, the Quran, is the theme of this expo. Held every year in the fasting month of Ramadan, the International Quran Exhibition opened its doors after 2 years of hiatus, driven by the coronavirus pandemic. Now, the 29th edition of the event has brought here exhibitors from Iran and other Muslim countries to present their religious products. While the expo displays exquisite copies of the Quran, it also gives a chance to IT firms to showcase online versions of the holy book, among other religious apps and software. The art section is one of the popular parts of the event. It features paintings, calligraphy works, and conceptual artworks, all themed with the Quran. Many of them are created here in the expo and then displayed to visitors.
We specialize in wood carving. Here, we are carving two wings that represent Gabriel, the angel. We will decorate each wing with Quranic verses, and between the two wings, we will place the Holy Quran.
My craft is called tashib, which illuminates the borders of a manuscript with delicate designs, mostly miniature. Here, we enrich the Quranic verses with tashib. It's very common to illuminate usually the first page of the holy book using tashib.
The holy month of Ramadan is believed to be the month when the holy book of Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad some 14 centuries ago. That's why this exhibition is held during the holy month, which is also referred to as the month of Quran.
Every Muslim family has a copy of the Quran in their houses to read its verses and ponder its divine messages as many times as possible during the year, and especially in Ramadan, as the month of the Quran's revelation to the Prophet. Now, one of the major goals of this expo is to promote the instructions of the divine book, especially among the younger generation. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. One of the points that has been frequently mentioned in the prayers of this month, both day and night prayers, is the issue of asking God for forgiveness. We must ask God to forgive us. In certain prayers, there is a statement saying, "This is the month of forgiveness." Asking God for His forgiveness is frequently mentioned in these prayers. Well, what does forgiveness mean? It means apologizing. We must apologize to God the Exalted. We must apologize to Him for many things that we did and that we did not do. This act of asking for divine forgiveness, which is done with a pure intention, gives you a purity that attracts divine mercy. We must try to attract divine mercy and divine blessings. In prayers we read, "O God, I ask you to bring about the circumstances for your mercy." There are certain circumstances which lead to divine mercy. This asking for forgiveness is effective in all areas of life.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There is an ayah, a verse, in Surah Al-Hud, in Chapter Hud, about the command affairs of life. And O my people, ask forgiveness of your Lord, and turn to him in repentance. He will send you the skies pouring abundant rain. In other words, God the Exalted shows heavenly blessings on you. After that, God says, and add strength to your strength. The Holy Quran, chapter 11, verse 52. This increases your strength and power. This is very important. This is not a personal matter. Rather, it is a public and national matter. The effect of asking for divine forgiveness in one of the most difficult arenas of life, fighting against the enemy, is more clearly explained in a holy ayah and verse in the auspicious Surah Ali Imran. How many of the prophets fought, and with them fought, large bands of godly men? But they never lost heart if they met with disaster in God's way, nor did they weaken, nor give in. And God loves those who are firm and steadfast. All they said was, Our Lord, forgive us our sins and anything. We may have done that transgressed our duty. Holy Quran, chapter 3, verses 146 to 147.
That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Midstream.
Events have been escalating in the occupied Palestinian territories for several weeks now. They began with a series of individual commando resistance operations carried out by Palestinian youths in different areas in Beersheba, Khdeira, and Tel Aviv, and caused a great shock and confusion in the Israeli security and military circles. This escalation was accompanied by political tremors in the structure of the Israeli coalition government led by Naftali Bennett after the withdrawal of the head of the Israeli Yamina party, Idit Silman, which makes the coalition on the verge of collapse at any moment. The gradually escalating Palestinian scene for weeks has taken on more interesting forms, with the increasing state of systematic Israeli incitement against Islamic sanctities, especially towards Al-Aqsa Mosque, and the Zionist settler group's announcement of their intention to slaughter sacrifices in the courtyards of Al-Aqsa Mosque in a move aimed at imposing a new reality in preparation for the demolition of the actual Al-Aqsa Mosque and the building of their alleged temple. The unity of the Palestinian resistance factions politically, militarily, and on the ground, with the threatening language they launched from the Gaza Strip, made the office of the Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett issue a statement denying the intention of the settler temple groups to slaughter sacrifices during the next 7 days of the so-called Jewish Passover. This explains the Israeli fear of a repetition of the scenario of the Sword of Al-Quds battle, whose memory still terrifies the Israeli occupation and its leadership, which suffered a catastrophic failure in the face of the resistance, its steadfastness and its courage in its fight to defend Al-Aqsa Mosque last year. The excessive brutality of the occupation's behavior towards what is happening in a state of massive revolution in all Palestinian areas reflects a state of hysteria, shock, and intense confusion among the occupation's authorities. In order to understand this confusion, it is necessary to understand a set of premises, as the state of confusion is not caused by an Israeli failure in the security and military tools in confronting the revolution of the Palestinian people. Rather, it indicates the erosion of the plans and the failure of the theories and policies that were applied to the Palestinians and which Israel bet on during several stages in the last few years. These are sequential stages, the first of which is the so-called Operation Defensive Shield carried out by the Israeli occupation forces in Jenin camp in 2002. Then the stage of the outbreak of the Al-Aqsa Intifada, and later the stage of the Palestinian division and the tightening of the iron security grip on the resistance in 2007, ending off with the stage that we are witnessing today, which is considered the most important in all previous stages, as the city of Jenin is once again at the forefront of the resistance scene as a starting point for Palestinian military operations against the temporary Israeli occupation. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Dozens of worshippers were injured on Friday morning as a result of the Israeli occupation forces attacking them inside Al-Aqsa Mosque after thousands of people performed the dawn prayer in the chapels and courtyards of the mosque. The Al-Quds Red Crescent said that it had dealt with more than 200 injuries, including injuries that varied between rubber, sound bombs, and violent beatings and other means of torture. Meanwhile, the popular and armed uprising continues throughout the occupied West Bank in support of Jenin and its camp in a scene that does not seem to be receding soon. In addition to the decline in the strength of a Palestinian Authority, the surprising development of the capabilities of the resistance fighters in Jenin and the resistance of the jihad movement to defend and protect the families of the resistance fighters, the occupation authorities anticipate the possibility of a dangerous escalation in the Gaza Strip as well. To discuss these issues with us from the West Bank is Mr. Mohammed Jouadat, political researcher, commentator, and writer. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Mohammed. Now, the occupation forces assaulted women, elderly, journalists, and guards of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and broke the upper glass of the Al-Qibli prayer hall to shoot the worshippers. Do they ever learn? Do Israelis not realize that with such violence, they are just leading to more resistance?
This Zionist occupier is part of a historical system from the old ages. They do not learn because of their arrogance, their conviction that they are God's chosen people. Unfortunately, this stereotype in the Zionist mind, which was expressed by the Zionist movement with the creation of this usurping entity, is translated every day with brutality against the Palestinian people. Today, they appear on us by breaking waves and breaking inspiration. This Zionist mentality that invaded Al-Aqsa was arrested, beaten, shot and broke the historical glass in the Qibli prayer hall in Al-Aqsa Mosque. This is a plan by Naftali Bennett, Gantz and Lapid, a plan that they started preparing before Ramadan, at the beginning of Sha'ban. They went to Washington and said that there is an escalation coming in Ramadan. Some thought they meant a Palestinian escalation. Yes, there is a permanent Palestinian escalation, and it's part of the state of confrontation, favoritism, and self-defense. But these people have a plan now, which is to bring about a change in the rules of the status quo in Al-Aqsa Mosque. This settler Bennett, an ideological settler, wants to give a gift to the far-right settlers. He wants to tell them, I have presented to you what Netanyahu was unable to do and what Sharon, Rabin, and Begin failed to do. He wants to say that we have contacted the King of Jordan, the Palestinian Authority and Egypt, and he will allow us to hold the blessings of our Easter blessing in order for the settlers to occupy the roofs of the blessed Al-Aqsa Mosque for a period of 7 days, and then contacts will be established with Gaza and Ramallah, and no one is moving a finger, unfortunately, in facing this temporal and spatial change, as happened previously in the Ibrahimi Mosque, in order to allocate a place for the worshipping Zionists alongside the Muslim worshippers. And if this is tolerated at this stage, the future will be even greater, with the complete Judaization of the West Bank, unfortunately.
Well, Mr. Muhammad, thousands of Palestinians from the occupied 1948 territories and the people of Al-Quds have flocked the Al-Aqsa Mosque since the early dawn hours every day in during Ramadan to perform prayers in response to the calls of popular and religious groups to protect the mosque in light of what you just presented and described about the temple groups, quote unquote, who want to storm the mosque and bring about or perform slaughter offerings inside of it. It seems things will only escalate. How do you think will it look inside the interior 1948 territories if it were to spread in there too?
There are many changes happening with our 1948 territories in Al-Fahm and Nazareth and in Haifa. Yesterday, they raised in Haifa the banner, "This monster is an illusion of dust," a statement which was launched by Gilboa hero Mahmoud Al-Arda. In Nazareth, they demonstrated the day before yesterday in huge numbers. In Al-Fahm, there is a permanent sentimental presence of Al-Aqsa Mosque. There are whole nights spent by our praying people who come from all the seats of the Palestinians inside our occupied lands in 1948. And whoever is prevented from entering protects Al-Aqsa Mosque, just as happening yesterday when entire buses from Al-Fahm were prevented from entering the Aqsa Mosque and they chased after the settlers outside the wall of Al-Aqsa Mosque. The land of the 1948 were in full support during the Battle of Saif al-Quds, and today you find them guarding this mosque. It's not possible for all the regional and local powers, whether in Ramallah, Gaza, Amman, Cairo, or the axis of resistance, to rely solely on these Palestinians of the interior. These people, in the early morning of today, closed the doors of Al-Aqsa Mosque on themselves and launched a violent confrontation with the occupation to protect the mosque from the settlers, and most importantly, to protect the mosque from the occupation policemen who stormed the mosque by the hundreds in order to protect a handful of settlers. These policemen are the most dangerous because they enter the mosque heavily armed and pull a barrage of hatred and anger on the Palestinian worshippers.
Well, Mr. Muhammad, the Islamic Jihad movement in Palestine affirmed that the Israeli occupation's attacks on worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque are an aggressive crime for which the occupation bears full responsibility as well as for its repercussions. Now, are we going to see another missile escalation, or this time the focus might shift only on internal lone wolf operations, which proved, by the way, to be very effective during the past month?
Jenin did what it has been doing since Sha'ban until Ramadan, and it has been in state of confrontation for decades, especially in the past 2 years. A year and a half ago in Jenin, the occupation vehicles received nothing but permanent confrontation with all their might through these young men scattered in the alleys of the camp. But the brothers and the leadership of the resistance in Gaza, perhaps a political stance is required of them to cut off contacts with the Egyptian side and not to receive communications that turned out to have no function but to pass on the temporal and spatial changes that occur in Al-Aqsa Mosque. The summit of evil that was held at the tomb of Ben-Gurion 2 weeks ago, in which Egypt participated along with other normalizing Arab states led by the Zionist entity. The summit was meant to pass this change in Al-Aqsa Mosque. Therefore, what is required of the leadership of the resistance now is to search for options other than option of communications there is always a third way. Today, for example, 10 vehicles of Zionist army entered Beit Hanun near Gaza. My point is, there are always ways to exhaust the occupier which he fears. The occupier wants reality to be either a truce or war. Yes, Gaza may have been thickened by wars, but what is happening now since Sheikh Jarrah in the battle of the Sword of Al-Quds and the great difference that the Sword of Al-Quds made in the situation inside Al-Quds, this difference is now intended to be blown away through silence, acceptance, and habituation. The habit of seeing settlers enter for 7 days during these alleged Zionist holidays in order to desecrate Al-Aqsa Mosque, while the police attack the worshippers, subject them to beatings, arrests, and impose exorbitant fines on them. Therefore, we ask the brothers and the resistance to make a political difference in their position and then to stand firm and persist in its consequences, because staying in this current form lead to the Judaization of the West Bank and the elimination of the Palestinian cause by pushing the approach of normalization countries that grovel to the occupation. For example, Erdogan thanked the Palestinian Authority because, in his opinion, it dealt wisely with the current developments in Al-Aqsa Mosque. What wisdom is Erdogan praising for suppressing hundreds of worshippers and inserting in their place a handful of Zionist settlers?
It seems that we are looking upon several weeks of escalation if the violence from the Israeli entity continues against the Palestinian people. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mohammad Shahradat, political commentator, researcher, and writer, for joining us to talk about the latest wave of violence from the Israeli entity against the people of Al-Quds and the people of Jenin as well. Thank you very much for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the upcoming parliamentary elections in Lebanon.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Well, despite the approaching date of the parliamentary elections in Lebanon scheduled for next May 15, doubt is what fills the air in Lebanon until the expected date, in light of historical experiences in which political forces cancelled previous merits under the pretext of security threats or regional and international external factors. The ruling elite is obsessed with the possibility of changing the parliamentary structure, and the pro-American forces are concerned and afraid of losing the race towards the parliamentary majority. All the while, this election session is witnessing a historically unprecedented boycott of the Future movement headed by Saad al-Hariri, a boycott that affected the plans of his Saudi-imposed political allies. Skepticism in Lebanon in this following report.
Lebanon is preparing to hold parliamentary elections on May 15 amid a severe economic collapse that the country has been enduring for 2 years and the possibility of the country sliding into further deterioration in the coming months. Despite the extent of the economic, social, and livelihood collapse that Lebanon is experiencing, and the elections will also be the first since a nationwide popular uprising in late 2019 that sought to change the status quo of the government, it also comes after the explosion of Beirut port in August 2020, which killed more than 200 people and flattened several neighborhoods in the heart of the capital. Since then, the crisis has hit every home in Lebanon, with the collapse of the national currency against the dollar, the collapse of purchasing power, the rise in food prices, and even driving to work has become a burden for the Lebanese due to the soaring fuel prices. However, nowadays the trending talk in Lebanon is the parliamentary elections. This seems normal after the country has practically entered the month of merit, and thus the countdown to elections day has begun. Yet, what does not seem normal in the midst of all the preparations is the waves of skepticism whether or not the elections will take place on time. This skepticism, in which technical factors overlap, linked to electricity outages and strikes by university professors and judges, and political factors overlap, linked to the lack of enthusiasm and fear of results, which forced the President of the Republic, Michel Aoun, and the Prime Minister, Najib Mikati, to emphasize once again in the last cabinet session that the elections will take place on time and the necessary funds have been approved. A new scenario is being extensively reported about in the Lebanese media, claiming that Western diplomats are now openly talking about the possibility of no elections. Some even sought to promote that international community no longer wants the elections to take place after opinion polls showed big progress for the pro-resistance team, which, as per the opinion of many, called for a Persian Gulf breakthrough, leading to the hustling return of the Saudi and Emirati ambassadors to Lebanon last week in an attempt to adjust the balance of power with the minimum available means. Apart from the debate of whether or not the parliamentary elections will be held on time, the electoral process has become more intense in most electoral districts, and this has been evident in recent days through the high level of rhetoric and the exchange of accusations between various contenders. However, all of the above, according to what those concerned say, cannot be a fundamental reason that justifies postponing the elections or cancelling them, as the elections have become a fait accompli that can only be overridden in the event of a major external incident, a possibility that seems remote for the time being.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Jamal Wakim, political commentator, author, and academic. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Wakim. Now, the question mostly asked at this time in Lebanon is, will the parliamentary elections be held on time next month, or will they be postponed, or worse, even canceled?
First, good evening. I believe that there are a lot of possibilities. There is a possibility that the pro-American team or coalition in Lebanon might work to postpone the elections because they think that they will not earn the majority in the parliament, that Hezbollah and their allies will be able to have the majority. And this will spoil the American plan to impose a majority that will take random decisions, arbitrary decisions at the expense of Hezbollah and its allies. And that's why I believe that this team and the United States will work on obstructing or creating a situation where the elections might be postponed.
But I was following on your analysis of the situation, Dr. Wakim, in Lebanon, especially lately on social media in the past week, where you anticipated that not only the elections won't take place, but you also said that Lebanon might plunge into another civil war that will completely destroy it this time. Where is your pessimistic view, if I may, coming from?
Well, it comes from the intention of the United States to project the embroilment in Ukraine onto Iraq and Lebanon, because the United States was planning since a long time to transform Ukraine into a bleeding site for Russia, and at the same time transform Lebanon into a bleeding site for Syria, and Iraq a bleeding site for Iran. So based on this hypothesis, I concluded that the United States might either work to earn the majority, or for its allies to earn the majority in the Lebanese parliament. This way they will form, let's say, a one-sided government that will take arbitrary decisions against Hezbollah, and their logic will be, we have the majority, so let the majority rule and the minority be in the opposition. Of course, if this happens, or if the elections are postponed, then the parliament will lose legitimacy, the current parliament. There will be no presidential elections, and all powers will be concentrated in the hands of the Miqati, Najib Miqati government, which is pro-West and supported by the West. So in this case, Najib Miqati will take these arbitrary decisions. In the beginning, Hezbollah and its allies will try to absorb the situation, the tension, but they will be pushed, and Najib Miqati will keep pushing them until they react, and this reaction will project itself onto the street, clashes in the streets between the various parties.
All of what you're saying is based on the opposition, on the pro-American side winning a majority in the parliament. What if they lose?
If they it's based on them winning the majority or canceling the elections. Mm-hmm. Okay, if the elections happen, then most probably Hezbollah and its allies will earn the majority. But still, if they earn the majority, they will be prevented from ruling. The Americans and their allies will revert to collateral plans or to contingency plans, so that they would be able to absorb the situation. And this, in case Hezbollah wins the majority, then we will see demonstrations in the streets after the economic situation gets aggravated. So if Hezbollah wins the majority, then we will see a deterioration, a further deterioration of the economic situation, increase in the exchange rate of the U.S. dollars, people suffering economically, starving, and then going into the street and blaming Hezbollah and its allies for not being able to resolve this situation. This is the American plan in all three cases. In mm-hmm. case the elections happen and the pro-Americans win the majority, in case it gets canceled, and in case Hezbollah wins the majority.
But the people can see clearly who was behind the policies that brought Lebanon into this crisis, but mm-hmm. we have Western-funded and backed NGOs along with Western-backed political factions that seem to be thrifty now when it comes to campaigning. They're throwing their money left and right. Yeah. Meanwhile, the working class is banned from withdrawing their savings and sometimes their own salaries, like what happened to me last month when I tried to withdraw my salary and they wouldn't allow me at the bank. Yeah. They said it's been too long since you withdrawn, and it was just late 10 days since I withdrawn. How long do you think it will take for a real uprising against the ruling 1% to hit Lebanon?
Well, too bad. I believe that the pro-American team is using all it could in order to divert the clashes or the confrontation from being between poor and rich to being between a segment of the population and Hezbollah, and of course between the people themselves. So that's why I fear that we might face a situation where we have a civil war.
Well, that seems a bit scary, to be honest with you, Dr. Jamal, but this is what the case has been in Lebanon ever since the ruling class finished off with their civil war and entered with a disastrous financial situation in Lebanon. I hope for the best, and I hope for the best for you as well. I want to thank you very much for your contribution and for joining us to talk about what might happen next with the upcoming elections in Lebanon. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
The light of Allah, you are a true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I am your humble host, Zainab. Dear listeners, as you know, we have been discussing about Mahdawiyat, Imam Mahdi, in this session. We have with us Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So Dr. Karimi, we had been discussing in previous session about the disappearance and reappearance of Imam. We have some sources saying that Imam Mahdi, ajallah ta'ala farajahum, he disappeared from the basement.
We have Ibn al-Qayyim, another Sunni scholar or Wahhabi scholar who is also famous for his anti-Shia beliefs. He also says the following. He says that the Rafidis, that is the Shia, they believe that Mahdi is Muhammad, son of Imam al-Askari, alayhi salam, and one of the offspring of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. He entered the Sardab while he was, a child. And then he says the following. It's for about 500 years that no one has seen this Mahdi. No one has heard any news about him. But the Shia, they are waiting for him. And every day they are waiting for him next to the Sardar, and they are calling him to come out and to help them, but they return to their homes disappointed, and this is their habit. They're doing that on a daily basis. And as you rightly mentioned, I mean, no one has seen the Shia to do that even once. Not only him, we have some other famous Sunni scholars, and they are not that famous to be against Shia school of thought. But again, the strange point is that they have repeated the same claim as well. I don't know about the reason. Maybe
the reason of the trick big lie works.
Yeah, that works. Or if you want to be positive, maybe the first one who made up that claim, he didn't think that it would be that famous. So much so that all these great Sunni scholars, they are going to narrate that without even one of them going to that place to check it for once.
Is it taking place
or not? So the next one in this list is Zahabi, the famous Sunni scholar in Kitab al-Ibar. He says the following. He says he is called Sahib al-Zaman, the owner of the time, because he's the last imam of the 12th imam of the Shia. And the misguidance of the Shia is so much so that they believe that he entered a Sardab in Samarra. And up until today, we know that Zahabi, he passed away in 748.
Right.
Up until today, Mahdi is hidden in the Sardab of Samarra. So it's very strange again that Zahabi claims that Shia believes that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is hidden in the basement.
Right.
I mean, no one has ever claimed among the Shia that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam disappeared there, or even he's hidden there. If he's hidden there, so he could easily be found. This is in Al-Ibar by Dhahabi, volume 2, page 37. The next one is Ibn Khaldun. We know that he's also a very famous Sunni scholar.
Yeah.
And especially his introduction, his Muqaddama, which is a well-known book on history, is very famous. In that part, he has also mentioned the same, and I would share. He says that some of the Shia, they think that the 12th Imam is Muhammad, son of Imam Askari alayhi salam. He is called Mahdi. And now the strange point about Ibn Khaldun here is that he says Mahdi, according to the Shia, entered the basement of his house in the city of Hilla.
Oh.
This is even more strange.
More far from Baghdad.
Exactly. And he's hidden there. Not only that, he says that وَتَغَيَّبَ حِينَ اَعْتَقَلَ مَعَ أُمِّهِ. He disappeared in that basement when he was imprisoned there with his mother. Now, you cannot find it in the history of the Shia, in the history of Islam, that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam has been imprisoned in any place. And he continues to say that Shia are waiting for him. They call him Muntazar. And that is why every night, Ibn Khaldun says every night, after Maghrib prayer, they go to the Sardab in the city of Hilla. They take some animals with them. They call him with their names until the night, until they see the stars in the sky. Then they go to their homes, to their houses. And the next time they come again. And this action is even happening in our time. It is, a continuous action by the Shia till today. Now, this Ibn Khaldun passed away in 808 after Hijrah, and he's quoting that in his Muqaddama, which is a very famous book, volume 1, page 191. That's very strange. First of all, he's talking about that Sardab in the city of Hilla. No one has even mentioned that. Even in the Sunni sources, in the books of history, no one has claimed that Imam Askari has ever lived in the city of Hilla. And second of all, he says that it is done up until today. No Shia has mentioned in any Shia source that in the city of Hilla there is a place, there is a basement. Related to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. And on a daily basis, Shia come there to ask Imam Mahdi alayhi salam for reappearance.
And that too with animals.
Exactly. And it is, repeating on a daily basis, if it was the case, at least one of the Shia scholars should have recorded it
exactly.
In the Shia books.
Yeah.
That we have such a place in the city of Hilla. People, Shia come here to ask Imam Mahdi alayhi salam for help, for reappearance.
Dr. Karimi, I'll be talking to you here. We need to take a short break. The listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.